Welcome. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to this place, this time, the first session in a series of meetings under the theme Faith and the City. I'm Jim Reed. I know many of you, but not all. Welcome to everyone to this time. Faith and the City, sponsored largely and organized by the Salvation Army Ethics Center. This idea of our theme, Faith and the City, well, I don't know. I think I was one of the people suggesting this would be a topic for this symposium. The Ethics Center every couple of years is committed to having a symposium, a gathering of this sort for encouraging people, especially people of Christian faith, to think about contemporary life and its challenges. And for me, it's just so impresses me that the 21st century is a century of cities and large cities and mega cities. Winnipeg, a city of about 700,000, would be counted as a kind of minor borough in a place like Mexico City or other large cities of the world. But I think we all realize this is a 21st century reality, and people of faith need to grapple with it. But it goes back further, and I think I said to someone a while ago, it seems to me the story of the Bible, biblical faith, begins in a garden, ends in a city, which then somebody said, the city that looks a lot like a garden. So in biblical faith, we are addressing issues of city. And in the Salvation Army tradition, the Salvation Army was born in troubled city in the mid-19th century and has in many of its aspects been known as part of the Christian church that grapples and tries to grapple faithfully with the challenges of urban life. So that precipitates our having this as the theme for the 2007 Ethics Center Symposium. The events are sponsored not just by the Salvation Army Ethics Center, but also we're grateful to have sponsorship and support of this from Booth College and by the University of Winnipeg Faculty of Theology. So we thank those groups for their support. Also helping and support this is the Deborah Jane Gowland Memorial Fund, and I trust you each have a copy of the little handout that says something about this fund for which we at the Ethics Center are grateful, and it helps make possible invitation of special speakers to come and help us think about the theme. And this year, we have Dr. Jonathan Chaplin with us. I don't want to take from his time. Just to say, I was reviewing some of the email and realized it was June 19th last year where I wrote the email, so almost exactly a year ago we started the ball rolling on this. At that time, Jonathan was in Toronto, and for a period of about 8 years, Jonathan was at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto, attached to the University of Toronto, then has returned in this last 12 months to the UK, and he may speak more about that, but you'll see he is the director of the Kirby Lang Institute for Christian Ethics, the first director of this new center, I believe, at Tyndall House in Cambridge, England. You'll see there Jonathan's academic preparation, especially in political theory and philosophy and economics, and he is an active writer in academic and popular contexts. And I'd just like you to join me now in welcoming Dr. Jonathan Chaplin to this time and this event.
Thank you very much, Jim, for that welcome. And thank all of you for welcoming me here to the Ethics Center and to Winnipeg, which is the first time I've been in this city. I've moved around a number of cities in my life. I suppose that's one of the few claims to expertise I have to address the theme of the city. I've actually lived in several, latterly Toronto, and it's always fun to discover new cities. This is the first time I've been to this one. And although right now I live in the country, or close to the country, in Cambridgeshire, very different setting the last 8 years, already I'm clamoring to get back into cities. I can't resist the appeal of cities, even though I love to be near the country, so it's good to be here. I'm not actually going to speak about cities today. That's going to be the theme of tomorrow's symposium presentation, and also a sermon I'm giving on Sunday morning. The title, I think most of you have the handout that I gave that was at the door, is God's Servant for Your Good, A Christian View of the State, which may have some implications for cities, but those will be drawn out tomorrow for those who are here. Actually, although my main training is in political science and political theory, I'm going to spend most of today's lecture talking about the Bible. And that's not just because I'm now employed by Tyndale House, which is a center for biblical studies, but because it seems to me that when we ask the question of a Christian view of the state, the starting point has to be the biblical witness. And so that's what I'm going to do. But before I do that, I'm going to look at a series of biblical texts and read quite a few sections from Scripture, Old and New Testament. But before I do that, in the first part, introduction, I want to just sketch some background and context by talking briefly about three background considerations as we approach this theme. And the first is just to remark on the revival of interest in this question, a Christian view of the state. I think one of the most remarkable developments in the worldwide church over the last generation or so has been the recovery of the political implications of the gospel. After a long period of neglect, indifference, withdrawal, or even outright opposition to engagement in politics, Christians are now waking up to the political challenges of our times and being confronted with the far-reaching political claims of the Bible in new and exciting ways. As a leading British political theologian has put it, theology must be political if it is to be evangelical. That is, if it's to respond to the evangel, the gospel. And this doesn't mean the politicization of theology, not the reduction of theology to politics, but simply letting the Bible speak in its own terms. So political theology, then, is not an add-on to mainstream theology. It's an integral part of it. And in the next 45 minutes or so, I just want to dip into one theme under the broad heading of political theology. Now, as I'm sure you're all aware, the renewed engagement of Christians across the world in politics is being worked out in very different, strikingly different ways. Some of them are profoundly encouraging, Christians committing themselves to campaigns for social justice, environmental protection, campaigns against poverty, and many other encouraging signs of hope. Sometimes it's ineffective, sometimes we find it alienating, and in a few occasions, in a few settings, it seems outright reprehensible what Christians seek to do politically in the name of Christ. And all of this indicates how very difficult it is for Christians and churches to discern the right way forward in this complex area of what I would call Christian discipleship. So amidst this baffling diversity or even fragmentation of Christian political witness and thought, it's all the more urgent, therefore, to engage in serious reflection on the political implications of the Bible. If not with the intention of reaching agreement, at least to clarify some of the key questions so that a productive debate can take place as we reflect critically on Christian political practice. Now, my subtitle is A Christian View of the State. There are many Christian views of the state, often conflicting, and oftentimes reflecting very diverse schools of thought indebted to diverse historical and theological and denominational traditions. I'm not going to try to survey those traditions right now. Instead, as I said earlier, I'm going to just read the Bible with you, not with the suggestion that what I'm presenting is some kind of neutral view that isn't affected by these various schools of thought. It certainly is, and perhaps you'll be able to discern them as you hear me speak. But rather simply to confront the text itself and to see if we can let it speak again today to our contemporary states and governments. That's one background consideration. The second is just some definitional clearing up work to define the terms state and political authority. Typically, when we hear the word state, we tend to think of our states, the modern state, this gargantuan beast that seems to surround us, monitor us, tax us, regulate us, assess us, frustrate us, and oftentimes give us some good things. That's the modern state as we've come to know it. It's the form of political authority that's come to dominate the modern world. And it's characterized by a series of distinguishing features that set it off against earlier forms of political authority. I'm not going to detail those distinguishing features now. The main thing to note is simply that the modern state is far more comprehensive in its scope of authority and in its power than any previous form. And I think we can see this both in the good which modern states are able to achieve for us and in the terrible evil that states in the modern world have sometimes perpetrated and still do. But I'm not going to talk specifically about the modern state. I'm going to speak in more general terms of political authority. To refer to any form at all of political authority in any period of history. Almost always, in every society, there is some structure or process or agent that exercises political authority, public authority over the whole of society in some way. These forms widely varying in different settings. It is possible, I think, to speak of stateless societies, societies that existed without what we now call the state. But I think it's not possible to speak of societies without any locus of political authority at all. And I think by speaking of political authority rather than the state, we allow the biblical witness to speak to us more easily, and we don't confuse what the Bible is saying about political authorities in its time with the particular form of political authority in our own time. And third background consideration, I just want to briefly say something about the range of modern views of political authority that have shaped our contemporary thinking and indeed political practice. There are, and have been in the last 400 years, widely differing views of what political authority is and what it's for. And let me begin by just mentioning one influential definition of what political authority is, and it's by the sociologist Max Weber. It's a definition which has had extreme influence, far-reaching influence, over a great deal of modern political thinking. He said that the state, he's referring to the modern state, of course, the state is that institution which has succeeded in possessing a monopoly of legitimate violence, or, for short, a monopoly of coercion. Now, Weber proposed this definition as a supposedly value-free, neutral definition, as a mere description. But in my view, it's far from that. It betrays a particular approach in the social sciences, a positivistic approach, which is not at all value-free. By focusing on the positive facts as they present themselves to us, this approach inevitably tends to ratify what has come to exist, and thereby legitimate it. And the tacit purpose that's smuggled in this definition, really, is the maintenance of the system, or survival. That is the tacit purpose of the state, if we define it in this way. I think instead we need an explicitly normative definition of the state. A definition of political authority, that is. A definition in terms of the leading purpose, the overriding purpose that political authority is intended to serve. And that cannot be mere survival or system maintenance. We need to know why we want this institution to survive, what good it does, if any. And only then can we make sense of the phenomena of the monopoly of coercion, which is indeed unique to states. And I think we have to recognize that this monopoly of coercion is not a mere brute fact, but rather it must be seen as instrumental to some larger moral purpose which it serves, well or badly, as the case may be. So very briefly, we need a normative definition. What we find in the modern world are contending normative definitions of the purpose of political authority. Let me just list some of them. I think I've listed these terms on your outline. For some, the moral purpose of the state has simply been the maintenance of social order. For others, it's been the promotion of the national interest, or perhaps the protection of national security. For others, in a more conservative vein, it's been the maintenance of tradition, historical traditions. In the 18th and 19th century, it was fashionable to see the state as the vanguard of social progress, indeed civilizational progress. For those in the liberal tradition, the state has been seen as the guarantor of freedom. That's the very reason we have states, to protect our freedom. Where have we heard that recently? For others in the socialist tradition, the purpose of the state is to mitigate the effects of capitalism and bring about social equality, and so on. There are many other contending definitions that people have proposed in the last couple of hundred years. Now, all of these, I think, capture something of the proper purpose of political authority. There is some value in each of those goals, but I submit that none of them captures the key thrust of biblical teaching. And I want to propose that biblically, the key purpose of political authority, the reason why it has been established, and why we invent it when it doesn't exist, and ultimately why God has given it to humankind, is the promotion of justice in society, in particular in the public dimensions of society. Now, justice is a word, it has to have some content. And like all those other terms that I cited earlier, its meaning is contested. A theologian some years ago wrote a book, Six Theories of Justice, and that's only part of the story. So just uttering the word justice doesn't resolve the question of what the state is to do. We have to put flesh on that term. And I think as Christians, the only way to do that is by responding to the biblical witness regarding the content of justice. We have to take into account the totality of that biblical witness, discern a biblical understanding of justice, and assess our contemporary political authorities in terms of that. And as we all know, thereby fierce contests exist already and will continue to exist. We can't expect in a secular plural society simply to be able to propagate our own distinctively biblical view of justice and assume that it'll be taken over uncritically. There will be battles to fight at every corner. So that's my third opening consideration. The task of political authority is to serve justice, and justice is a term that we must not take over uncritically from secular theories as they've come to exist in our society, but to forge a distinctive understanding of justice in response to the biblical witness. Okay, now let me move on to my second major section, biblical perspectives. And let me begin then by saying a little bit more about the term justice in Scripture. Seems to me that there are two key Old Testament terms that convey the meaning of what today we speak of as justice. Now, I'm no Hebrew scholar, but Hebrew commentators reassure me that these are the two key words. One of them is tzedakah, and the other is mishpat. And these terms litter the pages of the Old Testament. It's impossible to develop a biblical theology, certainly an Old Testament theology, without running into these terms all over the place. And what's astonishing is that these terms are not at the center of our biblical theology today. That's only been possible by screening them out over many centuries. We need to bring them back to center stage. So let me say a little bit about each of them. The first one, tzedakah, typically translated in English as righteousness, can also be translated by other terms as well. But one of the problems with that translation, which in itself is fine, is that the word righteousness has, for various reasons, come to be associated with personal sanctification. We think of righteous individuals, and that's, of course, an integral part of it. You cannot have righteousness in the public realm without righteous individuals. But righteousness, tzedakah, refers to something much more comprehensive than that. It refers to the order of right relationships across a whole society which give content to justice. Now, to grasp this fully, we'd need to take into view the entirety of Old Testament teaching on all kinds of different matters of justice. Obviously, there's no time to do that. Let me just throw one out, which I'll return to again a bit later. As we read the Old Testament, discerning the pattern of social relationships that is called for in Old Testament law, one of the things we see is a pattern of just economic arrangements aiming to preserve every Israelite family in a situation of economic self-sufficiency or independence. It's designed to protect and restore the poor, those that lose economic independence and have to become dependent on others. It's a way of securing a just distribution of key economic resources, which in Old Testament times was land. And it's also a way of protecting the integrity of the family, in Old Testament terms, the extended family, which is central to a healthy society and a healthy community, then as now. It's this cluster of just economic arrangements that lies behind the Jubilee provisions. Renewed interest was discovered some years ago with the Jubilee campaign regarding the cancellation of third world debts. It's behind very detailed legal provisions in the Old Testament, such as the prohibition on moving your neighbor's landmark. That comes up at several points. Why is it so bad to move your neighbor's landmark? Because if you move your neighbor's landmark, you are undermining their economic security and independence. It's behind seemingly trivial provisions in the Old Testament, such as the law on gleaning. That was the right of poor people to gather the remains of a harvest after the farmer had completed the harvesting. That was a legal right in the Old Testament. Now, that's just one example of a cluster of particular laws and provisions and structures that give content to the meaning of this Old Testament word tzedakah. Justice has a very particular concrete shape. It's not simply an abstract principle, as it has so often become in modern political thinking. That's the first, tzedakah. The second is mishpat. So if tzedakah refers to the order of right relationships giving content to justice, mishpat refers to the active doing of justice, the active rendering of justice. The original context refers to deciding cases, local courts deciding legal cases over matters of justice. And Oliver O'Donovan has used the term judgment, quite rightly, to refer to this sense of justice. Cases are to be decided, then, under mishpat, according to tzedakah, which is the content of justice. Indeed, everyone in Israelite society was seen to be sharing in this responsibility. Justice was not simply the preserve of judges, it's the responsibility of everyone. Nevertheless, political authorities play a special role. And in ancient Israel, there were various political offices which discharged that role in different ways. There was a system of tribal elders and officials, sort of local government and regional governments. There were judges, and there were kings. And in addition, there were prophets, whose task was not primarily to administer justice, but to critique those who were failing to administer it, to call judges and kings back to their responsibilities. So political authority, then, is not passive, it's active in the face of injustice. And yet, at the same time, political authority in biblical times was limited. It was limited to the doing of justice, which meant that it had a huge responsibility, but it was a well-defined responsibility. Political authorities were not to govern the whole of society. They were not to launch imperial projects. They were not to seek to transform a whole structure of society according to some blueprint or ideological plan. And crucially, they were not to take over responsibilities that were properly allocated by God to others, to individuals, to families, to priests, to Levites, to parents, spouses, and so on. So I think we can say that in the biblical vision, authority is distributed, it's plural, and each particular location of authority limits the other. The Bible is thoroughly opposed to any excessive concentration of authority in any one center, whether that's social, economic, political, or even religious. So those are some broad considerations about the meaning of justice in the Old Testament, read in the light of those two key terms, tzedakah and mishpat. And now let me turn in the next section to some particular texts, which I'm going to read at some length to you, focusing specifically on the task of political authority. And I think we'll see that what I've said up to now is borne out as we look at these specific texts. I've got several listed on your sheet. I'm keeping an eye on the clock. We may not have time to get through all of them, so we'll see how we do. The first one is Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 to 20. And let me just read much of this passage to you, because I think it's a very evocative passage that defines the terms in which political authority is understood throughout the Old Testament. This is Moses speaking to the people before they enter the Promised Land. When you have come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set over you a king whom the Lord your God will choose. One of your own community you may set as king over you. You are not permitted to put a foreigner over you who is not of your own community. Even so, he must not acquire many horses for himself, and he must not acquire many wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Also silver and gold he must not acquire in great quantity for himself. When he has taken the throne of his kingdom, he shall have a copy of this law written for him in the presence of the Levitical priests. It shall remain with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, diligently observing all the words of this law and these statutes, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandments, either to the right or to the left. It's a powerful passage. Many people think that in the Old Testament, and they derive this, in fact, from the next passage I'm going to read, from 1 Samuel 8, that kingship itself was some kind of a failure in the Old Testament. I don't read it that way. I think the particular institution of monarchy was not in itself either right or wrong. It's one of those varying forms of political authority that can come and go, depending on circumstances. Here it seems that God allows Israel to set up a king. But look how many fences are around the king. Look how far kingship is hedged around with limitations. The main limitation is that if the people want to set up a king, the king should not be one like all the nations around about. Those kings in the ancient Near East were, generally speaking, militaristic autocrats, claiming absolute power over land, territory, and people. This was not the kind of king that God was authorizing. Rather, a biblical king under God was to be limited in at least four ways, and they're listed in the passage I just read. First, the king was to maintain minimal armed forces, rejecting the advanced military technology of surrounding nations. Second, the king was to sustain no excessive royal court, not many wives, no heavy taxation. Third, the king was to remain under the law, bound by all the provisions of the law, including all the provisions for justice that I just described a moment ago. And fourth, the king was to be a member of the community, of the covenant community, and a servant of the community. The king was not to exalt himself above the community, as the ancient Near Eastern kings routinely did. Rather, he was to regard himself as a brother, equal in standing with every other member, but no higher. This was a radically different view of kingship than that prevailing in the ancient Near East. And to cut a long story short, I think it's true to say that it has had a tempering impact on the structure of our political authorities in the Western tradition, in spite of all their failings. That's the first passage. Let me move now to the next one, which is 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 to 9 in the first instance. And here we seem to get a different picture of kingship, although I think these passages are ultimately coherent. This passage warns specifically against the dangers of concentrating too much power in the monarchy, the dangers of centralization, as we might put it today. I won't read the entire passage. Some of you will know the story. What happens is that the people demand a king. So, as it were, the opportunity that was provided for in Deuteronomy comes to pass at this time in biblical history. The people demand a king. Samuel says no. God says yes, but at the same time, you'll get what you're asking for. Let me spell that out a bit. The people's demand for a king is driven by very mixed motives. On the one hand, the passage makes clear that there has been a serious breakdown of political justice. Samuel's sons do not do mishpat. They do not render justice. Serious injustices are going unaddressed. And Samuel, the prophet, has failed, clearly, in his role as judge to ensure that those under him are doing justice. But what do the people ask for? They ask for a king like the nations round about. This is the sense in which they're rejecting God. Not that they're asking for a king per se, but that they're asking for a king like the nations round about. If they'd been faithful, God would have been their just king, and under him, true justice would have been done by those appointed for the task. But surprisingly, God approves their request anyway, while at the same time, through Samuel, issuing a dire warning about what will follow. They will get what they have asked for, which is not true justice, but a king like the nations round about. Let me just read now verses 11 to 18, which spell out the consequences that God warns the people of Israel about through Samuel. Samuel said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots, the latest military technology of the day. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves. It goes on and on. I won't read the full depressing story. It just gets worse and worse and worse. Now, the subsequent history of Israel, as recorded in the historical books, is a vindication of this warning. It proves exactly what God said would happen. If the people want nations like the nations round about, that's what they will get. And in a sense, that's how God judges the people for their sin, by giving them exactly what they wanted. There are some exceptions. There are some righteous kings. There are some half and half kings. There are some mediocre kings. There are some outstanding kings, like David, at least for most of his life. So that passage, I think, is a stark warning against the dangers of excessive concentrations of political or economic power. It speaks to us today very powerfully. And let me just move on to really one of my favorite Old Testament passages. I'm keeping an eye on the clock, but I can't pass by without talking about 1 Kings 21, the story of Naboth's vineyard. Let's see, how many of you know the story of Naboth's vineyard? Okay, most have some recognition. Okay, it's a long chapter. I certainly won't read all of it, but I love this story so much. 3 key protagonists. King Ahab, one of the bad guys, his wife Jezebel, one of the bad girls, and Naboth. And what we find in this passage is a precise outworking of exactly what has been warned about in 1 Samuel chapter 8, specifically verse 14, which I just read. He, the king, he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. Let's see how this works out. King Ahab invites Naboth, who is a prosperous and devout landowner, to exchange or sell his vineyard. It's obviously a pretty substantial piece of real estate. Naboth refuses. Ahab's wife successfully conspires against him and gets him killed in order to get the vineyard anyway. That's the story in a nutshell. The key line in the story is a single 10-word sentence of Naboth. In verse 3, he says this to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance. The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance." There's more contained in those 10 words that resonates through the whole of the Bible than in many other single sentences as we unpack it. Why does the Lord forbid Naboth to give King Ahab his ancestral inheritance? Well, what's going on here, what's referred to by my ancestral inheritance, is exactly what I just mentioned earlier. The specific social and economic arrangement whereby economic independence was secured for every Israelite. There was a very specific system of landholding established in the Old Testament. It's quite unique. It meant that a single plot of land awarded to that family at the division of Canaan many years before is held by that family in perpetuity. It's their right forever. That family and its descendants has guaranteed access to economic resources for the foreseeable future. It's the basis of the Jubilee laws of Leviticus 25, calling for a return of all land to its original owners every 50 years. And it's designed, as I hinted earlier, to prevent the emergence of a permanent class of landless, poor people. So what Naboth calls my ancestral inheritance, he's not referring to his sentimental attachment to this particular piece of land. He's referring to the key, one of the keys at least, to the entire Old Testament system of justice, tzedakah. That is why the Lord forbids that King Ahab should get his greedy hands on it. Because if King Ahab gets away with this, if it becomes legitimate in Israel for people to give up their perpetual inheritances, then the entire system of justice is going to break down. And the poor will increase and be defenseless. And there will be no one to redress the balance. That's why I like that passage so much. Naboth is one of those characters that has a very brief walk-on part in the Bible. He only says 10 words. And yet those 10 words count for so much when we understand exactly what he's saying. Okay, let me move on now briefly. I'm going to skip a couple of these passages. I'm going to move to the New Testament. We can't have a Christian view of the state based on the Bible without letting the New Testament speak. there isn't time to go through everything I wanted to say. I think I'm going to skip Romans 13. It may be that this comes out in question times later on. That's a fascinating passage. Typically, when Christians think of what the Bible says about the state, they will immediately gravitate to Romans 13, and rightly so. It's a classic passage in which Paul expounds on the meaning of government and the purpose of government. I deliberately didn't start there because I wanted to situate that passage and other New Testament passages against the background of the Old Testament in order to stress the fundamental continuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and in order to encourage us to read New Testament passages through the eyes of the Old Testament. So, unfortunately, I'll have to leave Romans 13 to one side. I'm going to skip forward to a couple of passages in the Gospels, just two of dozens that could be selected. Incidentally, if you want to read about this, a book I've just read, which has helped me prepare and which I recommend to you, is by a friend of mine in Cambridge, Alan Storkey, and it's called Jesus and Politics. It's a great read. First passage is Matthew 20, verses 25 to 8. And again, it's one that you may well be familiar with. Sketches a model of servant rulership. Matthew 20, 25 to 8. Context is that James and John have been, through their mother, trying to secure themselves cabinet positions in the future kingdom of God. One at your right hand and one at your left. And Jesus says, "You've missed the point entirely. My kingdom is not about clamoring for power, imposing the kingdom of God by force, as many contemporary Jewish schools of thought were expecting. Rather, it's about self-giving servant leadership." This is what he says. Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." There's so much in those three or four verses there. It's almost a centerpiece of so much of Jesus' teaching about the whole of gospel living, never mind society and politics. First thing I want to say is that this passage is not simply talking about what today we'd call church leadership. It's not as if Jesus, as it were, uses politics, the Roman Empire, as a mere sermon illustration to talk about the internal life of the church. Rather, this is one of those statements which has comprehensive meaning. It's a classic kingdom passage. Jesus is calling his disciples to exemplify this type of self-giving servant leadership in every sphere of life, and it's continuous with everything else in his life, ministry, and death. But I also suggest it's continuous with the passage in Deuteronomy. The king, as depicted in Deuteronomy 17 that I just read, would be this kind of servant leader, obeying the law of kingship as set out there. There's no radical discontinuity in that regard between Old Testament models of leadership and authority and New Testament. I think there's no suggestion here that Jesus is calling into question the right of governments to exist, nor its right even to exercise coercion in pursuit of its task of justice. Rather, the implication seems to me to be that when it does so, or when it doesn't, it should act exclusively and precisely to serve the purposes of justice, and never with the intention of self-aggrandizement or expansion for its own sake. Equally, moving laterally briefly, we can say, I think, that governments also ought to be guided by Jesus' principle, "Blessed are the peacemakers." As individuals and communities, we should do that in ways that lie within our own responsibilities and powers. And equally, government should also do it in theirs. And that may, I suggest, involve a restrained deployment of force as one component of a much larger strategy of peacemaking or peace building. That's one passage. Let me move to the next and final passage, Matthew 22, 15 to 22, where Jesus addresses the question of taxation. Again, I expect many of you will be familiar with this passage. In that passage, I won't read all of it at all, Jesus is deceitfully questioned by the Pharisees over whether it's legitimate for Jews to pay taxes to Caesar. And he gives this famous answer. He calls for a coin bearing the image of Caesar to be brought to him, and says, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's." A phrase I'm sure you've heard many times. What he's saying there is clearly not that there are two parallel spheres of authority, one belonging to Caesar and the other belonging to God, which somehow stand alongside each other. The coin in the story was very likely to have had a particular inscription on it, and it was probably this: Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. This inscription represented the emperor's pretensions to a quasi-divine status. This, of course, was reprehensible to devout Jews. It's reprehensible to Jesus as well. But, of course, for Jesus to publicly deny the authority of the emperor would lead to his immediate arrest, which is what the Pharisees wanted. So his answer avoids that literal denial, but in effect makes a much bigger and more far-reaching assertion that all authority over human life is from God, even the emperor's authority, and that all that the emperor is really entitled to is a mere piece of coinage. It's a radical relativization of the authority of a government and empire in relation to God. Now, let me briefly wrap this up. These are just some examples, a few scattered examples from the Old Testament and the New Testament, but I think they're representative. And I think they confirm a general claim that the stance of Jesus and the early church to the politics of their time indicates a continuity with the central view of political authority and justice in the Old Testament. But it's not just a story of continuity, as if the New Testament were just more of the old. Clearly, there is a radical shift that takes place from the old to the new covenant. And I describe it this way, that what comes about in Jesus and in the New Testament is a radical deepening or a radicalization of that view, of the Old Testament view, in the light of the universal kingdom established through Christ. A kingdom, as I said earlier, established by the way of the cross, rather than through military victory for a single chosen nation. And that radical deepening lends a sharp edge to the New Testament's critique of the practice of political authority by the various rulers of first century Palestine, and by implication of those of our own times. But it's a critique that presupposes a prior normative view of the purpose of government, and of government as established as a gift of God for the benefit of humankind, an agent under God for the doing of justice, that is, as my title has it, God's servant for your good. And the task of facing Christian discipleship today, which is no time to spell out now, is to begin to discern collectively, through dialogue, through engagement with Scripture, through reflection on our own political engagement, and on the idols of our time and the injustices of our societies, to begin to discern how to bring influence to bear on our own governments to bring them somewhat closer to that high calling. Thank you very much.